Start off with that. Naturally, when you're going to do this, you wake up the day before with a sore throat. But God's going to get me through this tonight. Do I have to read the manual? My name is Joe Martindale, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I've been known to take a pill or two now and then in a pinch. My home group is a Rock Bottom group in Benton, Arkansas, and my sobriety date is February 21st, 1978, and that's a miracle. A large portion of my sobriety and getting me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is due to my Al-Anon spouse, Betty, and y'all have all seen her when she stood up a while ago, but she is the one that got my attention, and I'm going to tell you my side of the story tonight, and if you want to hear the truth, come back in the morning at 10. But I'm real grateful to be here. It's real special to meet friends that we met a couple years ago and have been involved with and see from time to time ever since. I don't know what Juanita's doing, but I think she's waiting for me to mess up because she keeps bringing me back. And I'm, you know, being a good alcoholic, I'm a little bit paranoid. But I'm a physician, and that's what I am. That's my chosen profession. And I'm going to spend the next few minutes telling you who I am to the best of my ability. I'm going to tell you in a general way, what it used to be like, what I used to be like, what happened, and how it is today. And I'll probably do a lot more on how it is today. I hope I can do that. Because this program has saved my life, and God did for me what I could not do for myself. And I guess that goes true for all of us. But I didn't become an alcoholic under a bridge. I became an alcoholic being too successful too quick. I was always in the top 10% of my classes. I always wanted to be a physician, and I set my goals early in life and achieved those goals. And success came pretty fast, just the way it was supposed to be. And Betty and I married right out of college. We've been dating, oh, I guess since 1947, and when we were juniors in high school, and so we're grateful to be together today and both be involved in the program. But my life is not really outstanding, except that I came from a dysfunctional family. I was reared in a home by my grandparents and my mother. And I thought at the time that that was normal, but after I got into the program and started working in the field of alcoholism, I learned that my family was dysfunctional. And I have a little definition, a little story about dysfunctional families. This family of four, which is a typical American family, were on vacation driving down the interstate, and they had a wreck. And there was this monkey traveling with them, their pet. So after the wreck, the police came along, but somebody had already come and taken the people to the hospital. So the policeman asked a bystander, said, "Where are the people?" And said, "Well, some good Samaritans came by and took them on to the hospital." Said, "Is there any way I can piece this together? Was anybody else with them?" And he said, "No, except for that monkey tied over there to the fence." So he said, "Well, maybe I can, they are pretty intelligent beings, maybe I can sort of make something out of this." So he went over and he asked the monkey, he said, "Were you in the car with these people when they had the wreck?" And the monkey shook his head. And he said, "Well, what was the daddy doing while you were driving down the highway?" And he said, "Well, what was the wife doing while y'all were driving down the highway?" And said, "Well, what were the children doing?" I said, "Well, what were you doing So, that is fairly typical of a dysfunctional family. But, see, I didn't know any of this. I remember my grandfather, who I never saw take a drink, but I knew he was alcoholic. And he'd sobered up many years before I knew anything about it. But he told me one time to be careful with whiskey because the men in the Martindale family didn't seem to handle it too well. But I had to go find out why. But Betty and I married out of when we got out of college. And I went to med school in Little Rock and did well in school, did all the things I was supposed to do. But I always thought that I got into medical school because someone else didn't show up. I always thought that when I was in high school and playing ball and making good grades and doing all those things that it was just an accident, that I was not worthy of that, and that I was a little bit less than and away from and not a part of. And that carried with me throughout my pre-Alcoholics Anonymous days. And our life was pretty simple. In med school, drinking was not a problem. But we'd go once a month, and the mentality of med school at the University of Arkansas is that the students get drunk once a month because we work hard and we deal with life and death situations, and we owe that to ourselves. And that's still present up there. And I guess in probably most med schools around the country, it's that way. But that was the extent of our drinking. It never was a problem. I finished my internship at Baptist Hospital in Little Rock, and we went into the service. Drinking was still not a problem. I never did drink very much when I was growing up. Sometimes we'd work in the hay fields on weekends and drink a little White Lightning and a little home brew, but that was it, and it never was a problem. But we came back to Benton, Arkansas, made a decision where we wanted to put our lives, make our lives, and make our home. And I became successful overnight, you might say, in my profession. I developed a big practice, a good practice, and real fast. And so I thought I was managing my own life pretty well because all my dreams were coming true. We joined a bridge club. Because when you go to a town the size of Benton, Arkansas, you get in with the people your age, the jet set, the country club set, whatever you call. I don't really know what you call it now. But anyway, we played bridge with some people. We had 12 of us. And as of my last count, there are two of us dead from alcoholism, and four of us actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we played a little bridge and drank a lot of whiskey. But we thought that was normal. And we went right on down with this, and everything began to go well for us. We started having our family, and things were just looking up. And then I began to drink more and work less, and this began a progression of my disease over a period of about 15 years, where I was working every day, and I wasn't impaired at first, but it began to reach a point where I was, because I started doing things that I never thought that I would do because of my morals and my background and because of my activities in church. While I was drinking, I was teaching a Sunday school class. I was involved in the Boy Scouts program. I was voted Scouter of the Year in my community. And I thought drinking was just what you're supposed to do. I thought that's what doctors were supposed to do, was to drink. And Betty was a little bit unreasonable about it because she didn't think an 8-ounce water glass of straight whiskey was social drinking. But I eventually talked her into agreeing to that, and of course, you know, if I wasn't drunk when I got home, I was shortly after I got there. But I started staying out, I started working less, I started drinking more, and I developed the morals of an alley cat. And my pattern got to the point where I would leave the office and I always had a bottle under my seat or in my bag. I kept it in my bag for a while. And I would drink all I could hold and then take off in my car with the intention of heading home. And sometimes I would get home, sometimes I wouldn't get home. And if I say anything, don't feel embarrassed for Betty because I took my fifth step with her. So I might not recommend that for everyone, but it worked for us. But anyway, that was a pattern, and then I began to get the paranoia that we get when we drink too much, and I began to feel the guilt that went with my alcoholic drinking. And I didn't know it was alcoholic drinking. I just thought it was drinking. You know, I thought what you were supposed to do when you drank was to get drunk and just obliterate everything in your mind. And I still think if I went back to drinking, that's what I'd think, because I couldn't stand the taste of it. But I would drink at night, and then I would take pills in the daytime to keep functional. And at that particular time in medicine, there was no controls very much on speed and downers and in-betweeners. You could just get them all. You just fill out a little card and send it off, and it just came in. And I filled out a lot of little cards. And the medicine came in, and while my colleagues were reading their mail, I was eating mine. But needless to say, when you mix sedatives and you mix amphetamines and you mix alcohol, you get a little bit crazy. And that was what I was doing. And I wasn't spending much time at work. I thought I was working real hard during those days because I must have been, because I was tired all the time. Of course, staying out most of the night every night was not really the normal thing to do. That didn't contribute anything to my fatigue, I thought. But we had a family, and we had three children, and we had people coming over to play with them, and we began to isolate from everything. And what I would do at night before I went to sleep, I would take a sedative so I could get to sleep. And I would time that so that it would take effect about the time I got to the bedroom. And Betty would think I was just tired and was sleeping well. But it got to where that didn't work. And when we'd have kids over, I'd sometimes fall over with my face in my cereal bowl at night, and they'd go home and tell their folks what had happened. And that was kind of the way that all the kids quit coming over. And we felt so guilty, Betty did. We kind of isolated from everything. We didn't have any friends that came around. We didn't have any social life at all. Everything revolved around me. I heard a young man say, and I don't think he stayed in the program, but it's very true about my relationship with my family at that time, is when I'd come in the afternoon, if everything was peaceful and serene, I'd start a fight. But if everything was in a turmoil, I'd just blend right into that. And that's the way we did it. And I had my hiding places. If any of you don't know, old tires are a real good place to stash your empties. So I was doing that. I was doing all those things. And I'd catch Betty and everybody gone. And I would round up my medicine bottles and my whiskey bottles, and I'd break the whiskey bottles with a hammer and put them in the garbage because I didn't want the garbage people to know how much I was drinking. And I was working every day. I was seeing patients every day and thought I was a pretty normal individual. And things just kind of went on downhill. They got worse and worse. And along with my medical equipment and my bottle of whiskey that I kept in my bag and in my car, I added a .357 Magnum pistol to that. because I thought they were after me, whoever they were, and that I might need that. And then when I was not working, I'd put that ancient age bottle there, kind of square. They fit good. They don't roll out from under your seat in your car when your wife's driving it. And they fit pretty neatly into a tackle box and in a medical bag. So that's what I carried. In the spring of the year, toward the end of my drinking, I went out to the country club to fish in the pond, and they had geese on the pond. They had three of them, and they were big and they were mean. And so I was fishing with my little red and white bobber, and the geese, every time I would cast it out, well, here they'd come and try to eat it. So I got tired of that. So I reached in my tackle box and got my trusty pistol, and I shot one of them on the water and got the other two on the rise. So I'm kind of known in the AA circles around Central Arkansas as the goose shooter from Benton. I've really never been able to reproduce that feat even with a shotgun. But the sad part about that was a Sunday afternoon, and I was out with everybody out playing as in the spring, and everybody was out with their kids, and here the local doctor in town is out there with a lethal weapon firing randomly in the air and whatever, and it frightens me. But the only thing that was ever said to me about that incident was, that was pretty good shooting, Doc. And I think the treatment programs call that enabling. The police would follow my son, my oldest son, who's now 37 and doing quite well for himself, was into alcohol and drugs from the ninth grade on. And they would follow him home and within a block of the house, pull him over, take him to jail, and then call me. And I would get up drunk, drive down to the jail, stagger in, sign him out, and drive him back home drunk, and nothing was ever said to me. And my community almost loved me to death because of my profession. And I say that literally, because I almost died from my disease. I don't deserve to be up here. But God saw it another way. But we had a lot of instances in our home. My son, my firstborn child, was into alcohol and drugs. And my daughter had a bad fracture of her arm one time. And she had been in the hospital for a long time. And we brought her home. And I found out that day that he'd been arrested for possession and public intoxication. And I just lost it. And he came home, and I decided then that what I needed to do was to get rid of him, because he was bringing embarrassment to the family. So I had a shotgun under his chin, and was about to pull the trigger, doing my fatherly duties, I thought, and saving my family from embarrassment, when Betty jumped on my back, and her sister also went out in the storeroom and got a choke chain from the dog that we had for the dog, and put it down around my neck and choked me down to the floor. And that's how bad I got from alcohol. That's what alcohol and drugs did to me. That's where it took me. And I thought I was okay. You know, I really never thought that this behavior was anywhere abnormal. But it kept getting worse. I began to get depressed, and I began to get behind in my work. And I decided that the most humane thing that I could do was to get out of the way for my family so that they could go on with their lives. So I didn't want to live, but I was afraid to die, and I was too chicken to commit suicide. I'd plot all these things about maybe pull in front of an 18-wheeler, but then I'd think, well, you know, all they'll do is just, I'll just get all broken up and I'll be laying a vegetable for the rest of my days. And I didn't want that. So I'd sit in my bedroom when Betty and the kids were gone and play Russian roulette. And there again, God did not have that in mind for me. And I don't know why, because I felt like that I had reached a point where I was just a sorry human being. And I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism. It never occurred to me that I was sick. I thought I was just sorry. And after all of that, things began to happen after that incident with my son. Someone came up, my brother-in-law came over, my sister-in-law, and they said, "We have just the answer for you." I said, "We found this Christian counselor down in Sherman, Texas, and y'all need to go see him." Well, I couldn't, by that time, I couldn't make it without a drink or a pill of some kind. So we headed off to Sherman, Texas, and I had a pocket full of amphetamines, and I'd pop one of them every once in a while. And the man tried to help me. He prayed for me and prayed with me and over me, and I told him just exactly what he wanted to hear, like any good alcoholic will. Had no intentions of changing anything, and just doing it mainly for Betty. So came back, and I never changed anything. I kept doing what I was doing. I didn't change any of my behavior. I quit drinking. I didn't drink anymore, but I took pills. I quit drinking and started living better chemically. And Betty says, then is when I really went crazy. And I know that now, because I was doing crazy things. I envisioned myself as Dr. Kiley of Marcus Welby fame. I had a motorcycle. I had the whole paraphernalia. My hair was down to my shoulders. I weighed about 140 pounds. And I'd ride my motorcycle to the hospital and to work. And all those cute things that mature adults do. But anyway, that was just a pattern that we had. And long in 77, a friend that I knew there in town came by and he said, "Well, why don't you go to AA?" And I said, "Well, I might as well do that. I've done everything else." I hadn't tried treatment center. I hadn't done that because I didn't think I was that bad. And so started AA, and first thing he wanted me to do after I'd attended about five meetings, I went to Cosmopolitan in Little Rock for my first meeting, and I stood up, sat on the front row naturally. I had about 60 milligrams of amphetamine in my belly at that time. And so it wasn't very hard for me to stand up and say, "My name is Joe Martindale and I'm an alcoholic." And I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. But anyway, after about four or five meetings, he decided that I needed to do, that I needed to make an AA talk. So sure, I was all ready, you know, I'd read the book and I was ready to do it. So anyway, I made some talks high on speed, and you can really make a fantastic AA talk. The big problem is you can't stop. But by that time, our lives were a mess. But the kicker was that Betty went in the other room at that time, and she started taking her program seriously. And I was playing with mine, and I played with it for a year. And what I heard when I went to my first AA meeting was, "Don't drink and go to meetings and read the big book." So that left it wide open for me to take pills. And I had access to them, so I did that. And I did that for about a year. And that's when it really got bad. And Betty went to Al-Anon and on a regular basis, and she started getting well. She started getting better. And instead of telling my office that I had the flu, she'd tell them what was really wrong with me the night before. And she began to not get me back to bed when I'd pass out on the floor. She began to not do things for me that she had done before. And I knew things were coming down to some sort of a conclusion, but I didn't know what they were. And she eventually got her black belt in Al-Anon, and I became a victim of Al-Anon brutality. I'll tell you at this point that I am, aside from being an alcoholic, I am a member of Al-Anon. And I had to do that because of my son. And that really has helped me a lot. I'm not as active as I was when the need was there, but it's a great program. And I would not be up here tonight if it weren't for the program of Al-Anon. I know that. But anyway, by that time I had sort of reached a point where I couldn't work, and I had taken to the bed. And I would go to bed, and when I'd wake up and have to go to the bathroom, I'd take another sedative and go back to sleep, because Betty for some time had been meeting me at the door every time I came home from work and saying, "We need to talk." And I knew there wasn't another subject in that household that needed talking about but me. Y'all pardon me for drinking the water, but I'm trying to get through this. But anyway, she started talking like that, and I envisioned with my super intelligence that I had that if I stayed asleep, then she'd soon give up and wouldn't talk to me. But one day she did. She came, caught me when I got up and came in the room, and she said, "Come on down and let me fix breakfast for you, or fix you a meal." I don't really know what time of day it was, but it was late in the day. And I thought, well, I guess all is well. So what I didn't know was that the condemned man ate a hearty meal. But I came, I ate the meal, and then she said, "Let's go in the living room." We went in the living room, and she said, "I'm not going to live this way any longer." So I said, "Fine, you just get all your stuff together, pack your bags, and leave, because I'm the one who's put all the effort into this home and all the furnishings and everything that you have. I'm responsible for it." And I didn't say all the heartaches and all that. I was responsible for that too, but I was. And so she said, "No, I don't think it's going to be that way." She said, "You're going to have to leave." So I said, "Well," I reacted, and I said, "Well, I'll just go somewhere else then." So I loaded all my stuff in my red and white Bronco, the only red and white Ford Bronco in Saline County, and I'd been trying to hide that. So everybody knew what I was doing and where I was doing it and all of that. You know, it was just like we're like ostriches, I think, when we get into our alcoholism. We think if we're not looking at anybody, they can't see us. And so anyway, I went around and I couldn't find any place to stay. I was so bad that nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. And I had reached a point where I was not superior to anybody. I was running with people that I never would have thought I would have been running with. But that's alcoholism. And anyway, I came back home and she was gone, and I decided what I'd do that weekend was I'd just get my two boys and have them to help me detox myself. And the physician who treats himself has a fool for a doctor and a fool for a patient. Because I was, at that particular time, coming down off the amphetamines, I was pretty quick. And I didn't know what I was doing. But anyway, it stayed that way, and I went on back to work, I think, on a Tuesday morning, and sitting down there at the office. I didn't have any patients by that time, but I got a call from the sheriff's office, and they said, we have some papers for you. Do you want us to bring them by your office, or do you want to come and get them? So in order to avoid embarrassment, I decided I would go get them. Well, what it was a peace bond, and I didn't realize it, but my doormat for all those years had finally stood up, and she wasn't going to take it anymore, and I had a lucid enough interval to realize that she had gone as far as she was going to go with it. So I looked at those papers on the way home, and I knew that along with that would come legal separation. And that was really tough for me to take. But I thought, well, I need to do something. So I didn't have any money, so I called. First thing I did, I had no money. We were broke. We'd used it all up. So the first thing I do is call the most expensive treatment program in Little Rock. And I wanted to check into that. But I couldn't borrow any money. My brother-in-law wouldn't loan me any money. Nobody else would loan me any money because I wasn't a good risk. So I didn't know what to do. And then a fellow that sponsored me and had been trying to help me, the one that was having me talk, make AA talks, had tolerated me all that time, all that year, came over and he said, why don't you go to Serenity House in Little Rock? And I said, well, I guess I might as well. I don't have any other place to go. And I didn't have any other place to go. I left my home, which was a nice place, a nice home. Betty and I had built it, and we were very comfortable. And I left that with a suitcase in each hand, hair down to my shoulders, weighing 140 pounds, and $200 in my pocket, and went to Little Rock to get well, or to get Betty off my back. I think that was really what I went for. But I got up there and I realized that all of my efforts in managing my life all those years, that's what it had gotten me, and I didn't understand that at all. But Joe McQuaney, some of you know Joe. Joe met me on the steps of Serenity House and put his arms around my shoulders, and with the big smile that only Joe has, said, you done gone crazy as hell, ain't you, Doc? And my brother-in-law, who had taken me, bristled because he thought that was my clue to go home. But I stayed, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't realize then that God's miracles were beginning for me. And visible miracles that I was going to be able to see and touch. But I went in, and he put me in a room with five other guys in this halfway house, and it certainly wasn't a fancy treatment center. I never got any psychiatrists to call me back during that time that I was trying to get into a place in Little Rock. And there again, God was working a miracle for me because, you know, most psychiatrists think that alcoholism is a Valium and Librium deficiency and treat us accordingly. But that's improving some too now. And we're conceding a little bit to them, and they're conceding a little bit to us, that we do know that there are people who have bipolar illnesses that need a little help along with their AA. And so anyway, I knew I couldn't sleep with those other people because one of them talked to other imaginary people all night, and they did weird things. And so I got special permission to sleep on the sun porch. And for 9 days, I went through the motions. I went down to the meetings every morning. For goodness sake, I had to make my own bed. I had to sweep my own floor. I had to wash dishes. I had to take turns cooking. I had to do all those things, which was very much below my dignity. And Joe never told the group what I did for a living. You know, I expected the first morning that he came in and we sat around the table, he would introduce me as Dr. Martindale. He didn't do that, and that really hurt me bad. But he knew what to do. He knew how to do it. He knew how to manage me. And so I began to get frustrated because I was like the little kid starting the kindergarten. My mind was so bad that I thought it was gone. I couldn't color in the lines, you know. I couldn't stay in the lines. And I'd look at the 12 and 12 on the wall, and it all kind of fuzzed together. And I thought that my career was over and that my marriage was over and that life was all over for me. And I had no idea that I could get well. But I remember Joe saying, "Others have recovered." And that stuck in my mind. But I was sitting out there one night after the nine days of no sleep that I perceived. I'm sure I slept some. But I went out and I talked to God, and I dared him, I guess, because I said, "Lord, if you have anything that you want me to do for the good of humanity, for you, then I have to get some sleep because I can't learn anything the way I am." And that was about 10 or 10:30 at night, and at 3 o'clock the next afternoon, one of the housemen came in and woke me up. And that was my proof then that there was a God. I knew there was a God. I never had any problem with that, and I had cash register honesty, and I had all those things. But I didn't know a God of my understanding. I knew your God. I knew Betty's God. But as far as I was concerned, he was putting down all the bad things that I did, and I'd have to account for those one day. I didn't have a forgiving God. And I didn't believe I could ever be forgiven for all that I'd done. But anyway, from that, I began to learn. But I didn't get honest because Joe would come in one night before he'd go home, and he'd hand me a stack of books this high and say, "Read these, Doc." And he'd come back the next morning, he'd say, "Did you read those?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I read those." But I didn't. I couldn't. But I did begin to learn, and I didn't know what to do with my life. I had an office that was empty. I couldn't get to my house. I couldn't get within 100 feet of my house because of the peace bond. And I found out later that Betty had called our best friend over to change the locks on the doors. And I really didn't know I was that bad, but I probably was. But anyway, I began to get into the program, and God does strange things, and he did some strange things for me there because Joe was putting together his program of Recovery Dynamics at that time, which is nothing more than an in-depth study of the Big Book. And Joe tells everybody that I was the only man in the house that could spell at that time. So I would sit in the room at the desk, and he and some of his friends who were working on getting this thing put together in study form would read out the things, and I would write them down. So I was learning the Big Book and didn't even realize that I was. And so things began to change, and then I began to get restless, irritable, and discontent. I needed to go home. I needed to go back to work, and I needed to do something. And I didn't think that I ever could be able to do that. But I went down one day and I asked Joe, I said, I knew something was happening to me. And I said, "Joe, I need to go home." And he said, "You're not ready." And then 3 days later, as I was about halfway down the steps, he was coming in for his morning work. And he saw me, and he called me down and he said, "You're ready to go home," because he saw the change. One of the things that I did while I was there, this was in this house was in the heart of Little Rock, the bad part of Little Rock, where you could get shot or get stabbed or whatever very easily. And I felt like that I'd been incarcerated in that place, and if I was going to be a prisoner, I might as well look like one. So I went down to a barbershop there in the bad part of Little Rock and had my head haircut down to about like that. And I really looked the part. And I had a blue jumpsuit. That was all I had. I was sort of, that was me. But anyway, I said, well, I've got to go to work. So I didn't have any work. I didn't have any place to work. So I went back to my hospital. And I was off the staff at my hospital because my records were incomplete. I hadn't completed my records. And Betty and I still weren't talking. You know, I did con her into doing my laundry once, but she sent a note back with it and says, do your own from here on. Don't send any more home. But anyway, I asked Joe if he would go with me to the medical staff. And I went and begged for a job, and they gave me a job in the emergency room. I was staying with some friends of ours down the street from us, and I was so ashamed. I was smoking at the time, and I was too ashamed of myself in my own community to go back to go to the grocery store and buy cigarettes. So I isolated myself in the house except for going to AA meetings in Little Rock, and that was what I was doing. But they agreed to let me go to work, but I didn't have any place to stay. I knew it was time for me to get out. God always tells me very clearly when it's time for me to change, because I get good, clear directions after a period of resisting and trying to figure it all out for myself. It's kind of like doctors will get sick and they'll have something. It takes them 2 weeks to figure out on themselves that they have it. And it's the same way with me and God's direction. But I start getting restless. And then I know it was time to move. So I started calling around, trying to find an apartment. My brother-in-law told me, he says, you need to get an apartment in Little Rock. You don't need to come back to Benton because you've messed up so bad here you can't come home. And it became very important to me to put my life back together where I'd messed it up. Excuse me. And then if I decided to leave, I could leave by my own choice. But I called one place, and everything I'd called, I had a problem with women, and I knew it wouldn't be a good thing for me and my sobriety to live in a swingers apartment complex. That just wouldn't work out. And so, because I wouldn't tell them that I was broke, that's for sure. But anyway, I called this place, and everything I would call for a while, when I'd call back and say, yes, I'll take it, it was already rented. But I found this place out. I said, I found it. I didn't find it. God found it for me. And it was way out in the country, about 12 miles out in the country. It was on in a dairy barn. And so I lived in a dairy barn for a few months. But it had a fantastic apartment in it. That was the good part about it. But the people across the road that had built it, had made the apartment while they were building their home. And so they lived across the street, and I lived there, and they were born again Christians. So I got a double dose of God. And when it got dark, everything got quiet. So I had plenty of time to meditate and to try to put my life back together. And at that time, Betty, she had reached a point where she would allow me to go by the house after she left and fix the ice maker. And I don't know if any of you know this, but probably none of you have ever experienced it. But in the years of active alcoholism, your places kind of tend to run down a little bit. When mine certainly had, it looked bad. And I'd go do yard work, and I'd do all that, and Betty and people would say, you know, I just don't think I would do that. I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I said, well, I'm going to try to put my marriage back together if it's at all possible, and I'm going to do whatever it takes. And at that time, I'd become willing to do whatever it took to get sober, because I understood a little bit about what sobriety meant. But I'd call her up. I joined long about after I'd been back for a couple of weeks. I joined Whiners Anonymous, and I'd call Betty up and I'd whine on the phone and say, you know, we can't live like this. And she said, well, we weren't doing a very good job of it the other way either. Bam. So I was working about 3 days at the hospital in the emergency room. And at that time, one of the counselors at Sorrenti House hurt his back and he couldn't work. And Joe asked me if I'd come up and take his place. So I was able to do that for a couple of months. And I know now that, you know, Joe didn't need me because I didn't have anything to offer. But he knew it would help me in my recovery. And so I gave him at the house what I had, which is what all any of us can do ever at any one time. But I'd go back and forth. Betty still wouldn't talk to me, but she was working at a dress shop that a mutual friend of ours had. And I'd go by because I wanted her to see how I looked. She's always been able to read my eyes and tell how I am. And I figured if she could see my eyes, she could see that I was getting well. And first she'd just get up and go to the bathroom. She wouldn't talk to me. She wouldn't even sit at the table where I was. But then after a while, I think one of the things when we went to court that sort of impressed me was that her lawyer told me, sort of as an aside, that if I could give her 110%, I might have a chance. I had no inclination that we would get together, but I was going to give it every chance to do that. And so finally she got to where she would talk to me. And I thought, well, what have I got to lose? So I'd call her up and ask her for a date. And we started over. And we started going out. And then as a result of that, we began to share. We began to talk with each other. And she had enough Al-Anon that she realized that she had a sickness too, and that she'd gotten sick because of my alcoholism. And we began to share things and clean out all this trash. And I'll never forget, you know, she always would say, I'm not saying this to hurt you, but. And she knew all those things. She knew everything. She just had to hear it from me. So we shared it all over a period of time, and then I still didn't have any work. And she and I had got back together, and we had taken some time to go over on Lake Washita, and we're camped out, and I decided that I needed a job. I needed a real job, that the emergency room wasn't enough. And so I had a couple of classmates at the VA hospital in Little Rock, and they were in high places up there, so they created me a job. And I went up, took my physical, came back into the lake, took my physical, and told them I'd get back with them next week to sign the final contract. And this has all happened on one day, and you can decide whether it's me doing it or just how you think it came about. But I went by the hospital to do my charts. And one of my colleagues, present colleagues, the only place that I didn't send a resume, because I didn't think I would have a chance in this clinic because of the reputation that these men had. And he asked me what I was going to do. And I said, well, I guess I'll go to work at the VA. He said, well, come talk to us before you sign anything. So I went back to the house after that, after I did my hospital work and got back in good graces. And I went to the house to get some things to take back to the lake. Within a 30-minute period, I had 3 phone calls. And all 3 of them offered me jobs, each one a little better than the other one. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to deal with that, because It had been so long that I thought I had lost my ability to practice. And one of my colleagues there in Benton, he had let me take his practice for a couple of weeks. And while I was working in the emergency room, my old patients would come see me, pay the emergency room fee to come see me. And some of you know how that is. That's a pretty stiff lick. But I got my confidence back. I'd passed that point of going back to my farm and buying me a tractor and getting me a trailer and living as a bachelor and farming soybeans. You know, that's what I was going to do. Sacrifice my career and do that. But anyway, on the way back to Lake Wachita, I realized what God had done. What that was all about, what that one day was all about, is that He had restored my choices. And I'd lost those through alcoholism. I didn't have any choice but to drink at that time. So He gave me my choices back. And then I said, naturally, as any good alcoholic will, well, tell me what to do. Show me the way. But God doesn't do that. He makes us make the decision. So I made the decision to go where I am today. And Betty and I were on the bottom financially. We had borrowed to our maximum just to live. I'd sold my office and the furniture in it just so they could live and I could live. And we got down to pretty much of a bottom. And I went to work for this clinic on a salary. And 6 months later, one of the doctors retired. So I was able to become a full partner in the clinic. And I'm sure nobody in here has had any problems with the IRS in their alcoholism. We had to use the money we needed to pay Uncle Sam. And so I had a pretty sizable bill to pay. But the first few months in the clinic, I was able to earn enough money to pay almost that entire tax bill except for just a little bit. God always leaves you a little bit. You've got to do something for yourself. And that blew my mind because I didn't think I deserved that. And I got scared. I got frightened. I didn't get frightened because I thought I was going to drink, but because I thought I was going to lose my program because look what I had done. And I went back, got in my old blue pickup, got back to Joe McQuaney. And Doc said, it's okay because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And what I was doing was getting up every day and going to work and doing the things that I was supposed to do and taking care of my business and my patients and my profession. And God took care of the rest. And He's been taking care of me ever since. And He takes care of me all the time. About 99% of the time, God runs my life and Betty runs it the other 1%. So, so you know, it's easy. Life is easy if you just let God do it for you. But things just started getting better for us and they have continued to get better. And sometimes it frightens me because of the continual climb in the way we feel and the way we're doing and the way we are with each other. And a lot of things have happened over the years and a lot of good things. We've not had a smooth thing. We've had some tough things to deal with. My oldest son, it's taken 10 years to establish a relationship with him. The one I was going to shoot. But last year we were able to go. He had a medical problem and he allowed me, his father, to arrange for his surgeon and to take care of him in his recovery process. And that really bonded us. We were getting better, but that's gotten so much better. And we talk every week. He'll either call us or we call him. And we never hang the phone up without an I love you. And he's even reached a point where he can say that first. My middle son is a physician, and when he was in training in Kansas City in his residency, he asked me to come up and share my experience with his peers. And that was really a positive thing. And he's now in practice with me, which is that's just a bonus of this program. And it's outstanding for me. One of the bad things occurred with my firstborn grandchild. And if I can get through this without crying, that'll be a miracle too. But she was born on a day that the state of Arkansas had seen fit to give me a community service award for my work in substance abuse in our state. And all I'd been doing was what I wanted to do and what I knew to do. And those things that we don't solicit are very important. So I was very excited about that. And I got my award, and I was about up to here. And I came back to the office, and they told me at the office that I needed to go on to the hospital in Little Rock, that something was bad wrong with Heather, our grandchild. So I got up there, and they told me that the neonatal cardiologist told me that she had a heart defect, that my last information on that it was not fixable. And I just about hit the bottom. But found out that things had progressed a lot while I was in my alcoholism that I didn't know about. I hadn't read my journals very well. But anyway, their lives just kind of came apart, and they had to live with us a while. And that child and I really bonded because they told us to not let her cry until after surgery, and then 6 months after that. I don't know why, but have you ever tried to keep a baby from crying? Well, anyway, we rocked a lot, and we bonded, and she became very special. And everything was going good, and then it came time for surgery. And I thought, they're not going to let me go back there with them. I'm not going to be able to go back in the operating room. But we were sitting in the waiting room the night before surgery, and I heard someone call my name. And I knew right off a dead giveaway was, I'm looking for Joe M. So I knew it was a friend. So this young woman came over and introduced herself, and she said, I understand that we share a common bond. And I said, well, I'm alcoholic. Are you? And she said, yes. But she said, aside from that, I'm the surgeon's right-hand person. And said, I'll be giving you minute-by-minute reports on your baby's operation tomorrow. So I thought, I don't really deserve this. But in about an hour and a half, the operation was finished. And my good paranoid mind said, no, that can't be possible because that's too quick. But the surgeon said he got a good result. And this child was on every prayer list in central Arkansas and in some outside of Arkansas that I believe in intercessory prayer. I see patients every day in my office that tell me, Doc, we prayed for you while you were having your problems. And I didn't even know they cared that much. So anyway, this child is okay now, and her checkups are all fine, and she's just a normal 7-year-old now, and we're very grateful for that. But God just takes care of me, and I don't understand how or why sometimes, and don't really care anymore. I just let Him do it. I mean, if He wants to work, that's just fine with me. And I've got 4 grandchildren in my town, and they're all very special to me. This one is a little bit extra special. She always will be. I don't love her any more than I do the other 3, but she's just kind of special. And her mind is, when we're around Papaw, when I, everybody take a number, and when I get through with him, you can have him. That's what he said. But I drive a Suburban in my work, and my little 5-year-old grandson talks about Papaw's big truck. And they love to get in the big truck. And one of the beauties of this program is that I can do that. My children allow me to take their children, and they trust their children with me to do with what we want to do and to have the fun that we need to have, and that they'll be safe with me. And without this program, that wouldn't have been possible. Betty and I have a loving relationship that we never thought was possible. We know one another. We're knowing each other better. And for us to be together with her background and my background and all the things that I did are a miracle. And she'll tell you about that in the morning. But, you know, I'm blessed with my work. I'm in a position to where I see an alcoholic almost every day. I'm able to do 12-step work in my office almost on a daily basis. And one of the things that I said that I would do if I got sober, if God would grant me sobriety, that I would never charge in my office to help another alcoholic, and that I would always stop and take the time to do that. And so far, I've been able to do that. But one of the things that I look at and I think, and I work with physicians that have trouble with chemicals. That's one of the things that God's let me do. Let me put together a program for impaired physicians. And he's given me the ability to talk to groups and teach from kindergarten on up through the doctorate level. And I'm a guy that's up here tonight talking to you. And before sobriety, I felt so inadequate that I wouldn't hardly read a paragraph out of my Sunday school book at Sunday school. But God has used me in a way that has just really been wonderful for me. And I like that, because I think that's what we're all about. Because when I quit giving it away, then I'm going to lose it too. But I thought I was so special. I thought I was unique because I was a physician. But I had an old boy in my practice that got bad years ago. He's got 20 years of sobriety. And he was so bad, I'd put him in the hospital to detox him, and he just, you know, he was just awful. And I'd look at him, and I finally reached a point where I couldn't take care of him. He was so obnoxious to me that I couldn't take care of him. And that was before I got sober. And I looked at him, and I told him, I said, I just can't take care of you anymore. You're just too obnoxious, and you won't try. I could tell you what you needed, but I couldn't do it for myself. So I looked at this man, and I finally realized after I'd been in the program for a while that why I resented him so much, that I knew that I could become just like him, the way I was going. And he and I are real good friends now. And God always puts someone in my path to help me to realize that there but for the grace of God. I've got a man in his 30s that's dying from the complications of alcoholism. And he looks like the Norman Rockwell picture of the old boy sitting on the bedside with the doctor by him. And I've tried every way in the world to refer him to a specialist, and they won't have him, so I've got him. And he comes in every day, and I look at him coming down the hall, and I just say, thank you, God. But that's not me. Because I could have been there very easily. But I can't think of anything today that I want, and there's not anything that I know of that I need, because I have it all. I have you. I have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a loving family. I have a loving community, and I try to give back at least as much as I get. Sometimes that's hard for me to do. But I can't ask for any more than that. in this life. And it's all possible because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people just like you that loved me when I was unlovable and cared for me when I needed being cared for. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. I thank you for being here.